Savvy regards to the staff at Nemata, and a special nod to newcomers who support the site. It's about 4 in the morning on the 26th of March. I just did a talk for Dakini Weather Watch 34, and I'm back again in a different room this time. The secret chamber of the Turton, you could say. Now, this is a place where I post certain material. Haven't done so for a while, and I tend to indulge myself. Don Juan warned Carlos Castaneda that indulgence was a fault among sorcerers. But of course, sorcerers are still human beings, at least in some measure, they're still human, although not completely human anymore, once you really get involved with the supernatural. So they do tend to indulge now and then, and I've done this. And I've used this this part of the site, this room in the school, for that purpose. So I don't know if what I'm going to say now can be considered as indulgent. I'm somewhat reticent. I have been reticent to say anything about this. But upon thinking it over for a couple of weeks, I said to myself, well, if we were together in a little community in the same town, and if we could get together and meet now and then, it's a great tragedy that we can't, I would want you to know about what happened to me 2 weeks ago. So here goes. I have to say at the outset that I do not know how what I say now will affect you. And I can't take responsibility for how it will affect you one way or the other. Talking to you, friend to friend. So if this happened to someone in the natural course of affairs, he or she would want his other friends to know about it. So far, only 3 people that know about it, and I've met them all in the past. One of them is here now. And I consider the rest of you who I haven't met and probably will never meet to be in the same category as those friends. Now, I don't want you to be concerned about me. So just relax and listen to the story. I'll begin the story with something that happened a day or so ago here at the bunker in northern Spain. I sat down at a chair in the salon to relax for a moment with Caerdwin, and I said to her, I feel like Lawrence Durrell. I don't know if you recognize that name, D-U-R-R-E-L-L. But Lawrence Durrell was a British novelist. And for many years, I read his works with great devotion. In the summer, 1963, after I graduated from high school, I found myself in Pennsylvania, where I had a job as a waiter in a summer resort. And nearby, the biggest town was called Stroudsville. It's famous because it's connected with the so-called Birdman of Alcatraz, great movie with Burt Lancaster. So we used to go into Stroudsville, me and the other three waiters who worked there for the summer. And that's where I would wander around and go into the local drugstore. And in the drugstores in those days, they had book stands, rotating book stands. And that's where I found the book by Lawrence Durrell called Justine. Now, Justine is the first volume in a quartet that Durrell wrote. And it came out in the 50s, I believe. And it's a great work of elaborate, beautiful, lavish, and somewhat schmaltzy romantic fiction. And being a romantic, I really took it to heart. It's called the Alexandria Quartet. Have you ever read it? Well, I did. I read it probably 7 or 8 times in my life. Justine is the title of the first volume, followed by Balthazar, Mount Olive, and Clea. And these are names of characters in the quartet whom I know by heart, their appearances, their mannerisms, their passions and their delusions. A lot of the story is set in Alexandria, Egypt, where, as it turned out, I found myself a couple of years later when I actually went to a place called the Cecil Hotel in Alexandria, which was a setting of certain scenes in the Alexandria Quartet. So I probably read the first 4 volumes around that time, 63, 64. And then, yeah, for the next 7 years, I made a ritual every spring of reading the Alexandria Quartet. Now, as far as I can recall, the last time I read it would have been around 71. So at that time in the spring, I was living in Santa Fe with my current squeeze. She was a luscious, green-eyed, Piscean woman. She often got mistaken around Santa Fe for Bo Derek. Yeah, she was a 10. I've had a few. And her name was Kathleen Freeman. So Kathy and I were living in Santa Fe, and springtime came around. The lilacs blossomed. It was deliriously beautiful. And I walked across town to a liquor store that was on the corner of the old Santa Fe Trail and the Paseo de Peralta. They had some really fine wines in there. So I carried out my ritual the last time I can recall in that setting. And I read some passages of the quartet to Kathy. I came home with 2 really good bottles of French wine and a big bouquet of flowers. Flowers were an important part of the ritual because if you buy cut flowers, generally they'll last maybe a week or so, maybe 8 days. So during those 8 days, I would sip the French wine and reread the Alexandria Quartet. Such a life, huh? Yeah, it's been tough. Tougher than you can ever imagine. Now, the quartet ends with a line that goes like this. And I felt as if the universe itself had given me a nudge. That's how Durrell concludes the quartet. That's the exact line. So I said to Carradine, I feel like Lawrence Durrell. And then I went on, and this is indulgent, but bear with me. Indulge me for a moment. I went on to explain something about that line. You see, I was so infatuated with Durrell and so in love with the story and the characters that I continued to follow him after he had written the Alexandria Quartet. Now, the quartet is, as I say, certainly at the summit of romantic writing, of romantic novels. Even though Durrell was really technically an individual of the post-romantic period. It was transitional. So you have the great romantics of the end of the beginning in the, with the romantic movement, of course, in the early 1800s. And then coming into the 1900s, you slide into the late romantics, like Rilke and D.H. Lawrence. And then you really, by the 50s, you're really into the post-romantic period. So his work was, you could say, I would consider it as part of the great sunset of the Romantic movement. And it is, as a work of literature, spectacularly beautiful and written in a captivating manner. It's better than watching a film. It's better than cinema. So there was Lawrence Durrell, and he had accomplished this work. Let's say, the peak of his achievement as a novelist. There are such things. Artists reach the peak of their achievement before they die. Sometimes, often. So as I said, because I was such a devotee of the Alexandria Quartet, I felt obligated, in a sense, to continue to read Lawrence Durrell. What was he going to write after he wrote a masterpiece that concluded with that line? Well, he actually wrote 7 books. He wrote 2 books that went together that he titled with Latin words, Tunc, T-U-N-C, which was a play on the word C-U-N-T, Tunc, which means now, and Nunquam, which means then, or maybe it's the other way around. So he wrote 2 novels called Now and Then, and I read those novels. And then after that, he wrote 5 books, which he called the Avignon Quintet. And they were set in Avignon, southern France, place that I've been off and on. And they were, again, elaborate romantic novels in the style of Durrell. But as I read those novels in the ensuing years, I didn't respond to them at all. I didn't find them compelling. At places I couldn't see what he was getting at. The characters did not appeal to me. And so I drew the conclusion that after he reached the peak of his achievement, mark my words, Durrell couldn't follow up. He didn't have a follow-up act. He didn't know where to take it from there after the universe had given him a nudge. So I recounted all that to Cara Dwin pretty much in the way that I'm telling it to you right now. But she knew what had happened to me 2 weeks ago, and she knew that everything I said about the Alexandria Quartet was an allusion to that event. So now I'm going to describe that event. And I'll try not to be too dramatic. It was on the 11th of March. Now that's right around the time of certain anniversaries coming up for me that have a lot of personal bearing and also refer to the Terma of Gaia Awakening and other things. The 12th of March, in fact, was Dolmen Day, which was the launch of the initiation that led to the Terma of Gaia Awakening. And the 12th, that was 14 years ago, my friends. And the 12th of March was also the day of my departure from Gaucin in Andalusia, where I had lived for 14 years. Since 2002. And the 18th of March, a few days later, was the anniversary of the third nail. So I don't pay much attention to anniversaries, but, you know, sometimes they do have some kind of power. They do carry memory, and sometimes they can be significant. Well, on the 11th of March, our car, a Kia, had come back from inspection. I left it in the hands of the local mechanic. He took it to inspection, and I was due to pick it up. So I got a call. They said it was ready. And they sent in one of the men from the shop, Carlos. He drove out to the house. I drove him back to the garage to pay for the car, pay for the work that needed to be done and the cost of inspection, and drove the car home. Now, the garage in Paradella is an old concrete building, and as you look at it, it has two big pull-up doors, aluminum doors, to the right and left. On the right, as you go in that entrance, there is immediately a work pit or grease pit on the right. Usually there's a car or a tractor parked over that, and they're working on it. If you go in on the left, there's an elevator that raises the car up so they can work on it in that way. So I got there that day, and Carlos and I got out of the car, which I parked in front of the garage, and we walked in on the right side. And I noticed immediately that there was a car over the working pit, as there usually is. And I noticed it was a very low car. It was unusual. It wasn't a typical vehicle. It was something like a sports car with bucket seats, very low. And they had removed the hood. So they were working on the engine and the hood at the same time that they were working underneath. And as soon as we got there, Carlos went back to the car and started working on it. So he was leaning over the hood, the open engine. Picture that. So the office where Miguel keeps his business is in the back of the garage. So walked back, and I chatted with him, paid him, came out of his office to leave. And as I was walking back toward that garage door on the right, there was Carlos and another worker standing off to the side, and they were talking about something, probably the car that Carlos was working on. And I had noticed when I came through the first time that he was leaning over the engine. And I thought, that's interesting. For just a split second, my rigpa registered that he was leaning over the engine. And my rigpa sort of calculated, it's just one of those things that flashes across your mind, well, the car must be positioned over the pit, so it's pretty close to the front end of the pit, intentionally, of course, so he could work on the engine above and go down through the narrow space if he needed to get underneath the car. So there couldn't have been much of a space between the front fender of that car and the edge of the work pit. It had to be quite narrow for him to be leaning over the engine. Can you see that? And I had remarked that in just a split second as I was walking toward the office. So as I was walking back, he would now be on my left. Can you see that? I'm walking toward the entrance of the garage to leave. And he's on my left, leaning over the engine of the car. Now, I can't say exactly how much space there was between the front fender of that car and the edge of the pit, but I am sure that it was not more. It was not 2 feet. It was something under 2 feet. It was narrow. So, what happened next was that I paused, acknowledged the other workman who was standing there. He was on my right. And I turned my head slightly to Carlos on my left, and I wanted to say something to him. Just a few words in Spanish as I was leaving. Now, I should add, because every detail of this story is significant, that I have this condition with my right eye, where my vision is somewhat occluded, so it's opaque. And one of the effects of this is that it disturbs the right and left coordination of vision. And one of the effects of that is that the contrast between light and shade, as I see it, is very sharp, and sometimes it's really disturbing. But another consequence is that I can't judge distances with 100% accuracy, in particular, if the distance involves some contrast between light and shade. So there was light coming in through the open door of the garage, shining on the garage floor, which was kind of a dirty gray. And then there was the rectangle of space of the open pit, which was black. And that is exactly the kind of situation which is affected by this condition of vision. I can't see it with 100% accuracy. So I come up to the car, standing just in front of the bumper of the car. I'm facing out toward the door. Carlos is on my left. And in the moment of turning to him, turning my head, not my body, to say something to him, I moved my left foot slightly. just enough so that my left foot was over the opening, the narrow opening to the pit. Now, this pit is 6 feet deep, it's 2 meters deep, and it's completely black, obviously, from grease on both the walls and the floor. So it's really just a black void. And in the pit, up against the end of it, where the bumper of the car is located, down in the pit, was a set of steps. No railing, just 4 steps, constructed from very heavy steel, hardened steel. So when Carlos wanted to go down, he stepped down those 4 steps to stand at the bottom of the pit. And when he wanted to get up, he climbed up them to get out. So those stairs were directly under the narrow opening that was left between the edge of the pit and the bumper of the car. Now, all of this happened not in a clumsy way, nor in an awkward way. All of this happened in a totally clear and sober way. There was no confusion, there was no stumbling, there was no lurching, there was no twisting of my body or grappling for a grip. I distinctly remember that when my left foot stepped out over the pit, I could feel on the bottom of my foot that there was nothing there. And the sensation was very clear and strong. I had shoes on, but it was really as if my foot was bare. And I could feel on the bare skin of my bottom of my foot, my left foot, that there was nothing under my foot. The consequence being that I fell into the pit. Obviously. But how? How did I fall into the pit? Bear in mind, this is an important detail, that the space between the bumper of the car and the edge of the pit was, like I said, under 2 feet wide. Now, I'm quite broad-shouldered, and if I had fallen into the pit face down, I would have caught on my shoulders or my arms. My arms would have caught on the edge of the pit or on the bumper of the car. Or if I had fallen that way, then I could possibly have lurched my body so that I fell on the engine of the car and grappled to keep myself from falling into the pit. But none of that happened. I fell into the pit like a slice of bread goes into a toaster. But just imagine that you put the slice of bread in diagonally. You don't put it in with the flat bottom down. You put it in with a point down. So I fell in like a slice of bread, tilted to my left. That is, I fell in with my left side going down first, and it's the only way I could have fallen in without hitting the bumper of the car, which would have been in front of me, or the concrete edge of the pit, which was behind me. How did that happen? Well, I can't say, because I don't remember falling into the pit. And so there are 2 events that happened, separated by less than a second. I remember the sensation of no support under my left foot. And then I was at the bottom of the pit. And I was slumped in the corner with my back against the long wall and my shoulder sort of against the short edge, which is where the steps were placed. So I was off to the side from the steps with my legs beneath me, but not in an uncomfortable or awkward manner. My two legs were just kind of folded beneath me as if I had casually slumped myself down in the corner of the pit. Now, between the moment that I felt there was nothing to support my left foot and the next moment, couldn't have been more than a second. It took a second, less than a second. So what happened in that second? And what happened after that second? After I hit the bottom of the pit? Well, I ask you to pause for a moment and speculate. Speculate, as I did, on what could have happened. Now consider that I am 75 years old and I'm not physically that strong, and yet I don't have anything wrong with me organically. I don't have anything wrong with my bodily articulations. So I can walk around. I can move, I can twist and turn. I don't have arthritis. I don't have any problems that would interfere with my movements, none at all. But I ask you to speculate for a moment what could have happened to someone of my age, or even of a younger age, who fell dead flat 6 feet into a pit. The way that I fell, I had to hit the stairs. Hardened steel stairs, four of them, because they were directly under the narrow space into which I fell. Now just imagine what could have happened. Just imagine the possibilities. Broken arm, fractured arm, broken shoulder. If I had hit myself on the edge of the pit or in the bumper of the car, that could have caused who knows what damage. I could have hit my head somewhere along the way, smashed my face, fractured jaw, concussion, displacement of the neck, and it gets worse. Imagine landing on those stairs. Imagine if I landed on an organ like my kidneys, ruptured kidneys, broken ribs, displaced vertebrae, broken spine. It goes on and on. That's a partial inventory of what could have happened. So what did happen? Well, nothing happened. Nothing at all. Between the time that I had the sensation that my foot had no support and the next moment, I can remember nothing. I cannot remember the fall. It does not appear that I was knocked out, and I could have been knocked unconscious on several occasions due to the circumstances of the fall. As far as I know, I wasn't unconscious, except for the split second it took to fall. So the next thing I remember immediately was seeing my sunglasses, my $240 Ray-Bans. And they were sitting on the bottom of the pit, and they were neatly folded. The two legs, whatever you call them, of the sunglasses that go over your ears were folded as if I had folded them myself and placed the sunglasses on the ground. And where was I? Well, I was slumped in the corner of the pit, sort of leaning off to my right. My back was against the long wall, my shoulder was in the corner, and my legs were kind of folded under me, but not in an uncomfortable or awkward manner or in any kind of painful manner. It's as if I had just eased myself down in the corner of the grease pit to relax for a moment. Now, Carlos and the other individual were still above, and they didn't do anything to try to come down, step down the stairs, and see what happened and help me, because they didn't have time, because there was no time. There was less than a second between the moment I realized there was nothing under my foot and the moment that I saw my sunglasses. So what did I do? Well, I reached down and picked them up and carefully unfolded them and put them on. And then I reached out with my right hand toward the steps and grabbed onto them and stood up. I didn't use them to pull myself up. I didn't slide up the wall. I just got up normally. And then I climbed up the four stairs and out of the pit. And I stood on the floor of the garage. That's what happened. Now, Carlos was right over the pit where I fell. And he saw what happened. And the other dude also saw it from his angle. So when I came up, they were both standing there, closer together. And the first thing that I noticed was that it looked like they were laughing. It sort of looked like they were, well, what expression did they have? I could say that their jaws were open, but really what I saw was that they were smiling. And not only that, but their eyes were shining in an almost gleeful way. Really odd impression. And they weren't in a panic. They just stood there, didn't look concerned. And then Carlos made a gesture and he pointed to my hands. And I saw, oh yeah, I've got some dirt on my hands. So the palms of both of my hands were somewhat black. And he gestured to me to limpiar, clean my hands. So it led me back to the bathroom in the back of the garage. And he went in with me and stood off to my right. And I stood in front of this little sink, which had a mirror in front of it. I put on the tap and I ran water over it and I washed my hands. And as I was washing my hands, I looked at Carlos And I nodded and I smiled. I grinned at him. And he looked at me with that crazy look. Really, his eyes were shining. And he didn't say anything. He didn't ask me anything. He didn't try to touch me. And he had no reason to, because I was standing there perfectly normally. And so then I dried off my hands and I walked beside Carlos back to the entrance of the garage. I walked past the pit in the car, which were on my left. I gestured hasta luego, and I got in the car and drove home. So what do you make of that? Now, there is a follow-up to this story. There's more about what happened when I got home. I remember that as I was driving home, it's about a 6-7 minute drive, I didn't have any pain, any discomfort, and I was acting perfectly normally. But I did feel a kind of elation. I did feel definitely, it would not be an exaggeration to say that I felt a kind of euphoria, definitely. And I felt that euphoria as I was driving home. So there's a follow-up to this story, which concerns what happened when I got home. But in case you're concerned, I can assure you that nothing happened. Almost nothing. Nothing happened. What do I mean by that? I suffered no serious injury, except possibly, as far as I can make out, dislocation of ribs. So there is some effect, some consequence in the intercostal muscles of my ribs. On my right side and toward the back, you know where the ribs come around, the back of your side, and you have those three floating ribs at the bottom. And over those, beneath those three floating ribs are the top part of the kidneys. And then there is the part of the kidneys that is just below the last rib. And if I had fallen there on those stairs, it's almost certain that it would have ruptured my kidneys, you see? But I didn't fall there. When I got back, it gradually came to be revealed from looking at my back how I fell. As far as I can tell. Now, I haven't had a chance to ask Carlos. They don't speak Spanish, so I couldn't ask him. But he and the other dude saw me fall. The best that I can do is try to work out how I fell. And the odd thing is that even though I slipped into that space, going down on my left side, apparently I didn't try to break my fall with my left hand or my left arm, in which case I might have fractured or broken my wrist, might have displaced my shoulder as I hit those steel stairs. Apparently, I made no resistance to falling. And apparently, and this is inexplicable, the evidence of the fall in marks on my back and swelling show that I hit the stairs on the back of my right side. How is that possible? If I went down left side first, I did I spin? I don't know how that could have happened. But it was clear when I got back and we started to look at it, and some pain started to come on, because there was pain involved. No disability. No serious consequence. But pain, yeah, there was some pain. But as we examined the situation, it was clear that I took the impact on my right side, along those ribs that curve around to the back. But how's that possible? How could my body have spun around in less than a second, half a second, so that I took the fall in that way? And if I took the fall in that way, why didn't I hit the back of my head on the back of the pit? And then when I bounced off the stairs, which is what happened, how come I didn't bounce face first against the long wall of the pit? How come there's no after effects? My wrist and my arms, apparently, I did not try to brace myself in any way, did not put out my hands to try to break the fall. But that being so, how come I didn't smash face first into the floor of the pit? How come I had no mark on my face? I had no grease on my face or on my arms or legs anywhere, or even on the back of my head, because I was leaning against the long wall of the pit when I saw my sunglasses. No, there was just some dirt on my palms, which probably got there when I pressed them to the ground to stand up. So there you go. I said, I don't want you to be concerned about me. There's nothing to be concerned about. Now, my ribs are not normal, but my ribs are not painful either. They pop now and then. And I understand from a friend I talked to that this has something to do with the release of nitrogen. So I guess the most you could say is that I dislocated my ribs on the right side. And yeah, I can feel them popping now and then. But it's not excruciatingly painful. And it doesn't in any way impede my normal activity. So the moral is of the story is that I fell into that pit and I suffer no consequences. The follow-up to what happened is quite amazing. The way that I behaved when I got home, I'm told, was amazing. And I'd like to tell that part of the story as well when the moment comes. But for now, I'll leave you with that. I'm sure that's quite enough for you to take on in a single dose. And I'll conclude with the last line of the Alexandria Quartet. I felt as if the universe had given me a nudge.